Hello, and welcome to another edition of The Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at Roberto Benigni and his 1997 classic, Life is Beautiful. Returning on the show today to talk about Life is Beautiful is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So, there are probably three movies I've seen in my entire life where I cried. One is Schindler's List during the I Could Have Gotten More Out scene. That scene always gets me to tears. The scene in Cinema Paradiso at the very end when he's watching the video his lifetime friend gave to him after he passed away, and he starts crying. That's an emotional one. And this movie, it's not the scene when, spoiler alert, but not the scene when he dies, but when the little boy is reunited with the mom and they're happy. And then it's the father voiceover saying, I'll never forget what my father did for me. That scene always gets me.
So. Yeah. Yeah, as it's meant to. It's a manipulative movie in a way that it sets you up for what is to come.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a clue that it's, you know, bracketed by the kid starting off with, you know, oh, now I'm going to tell you my story. And then he comes back at the end and says, so that was my story. The fact that the kid's the narrator does give you a hint that he's the one who survives to tell the tale.
Yeah, and what's interesting is the way the movie makes you think that Roberto Benigni's going to survive. He's going to make it. Like the one scene when the Nazi's pointing the gun at him, he's about to pull the trigger, but the other officer talks to him. You think, oh, he's going to leave him alone or he'll escape. But nope, it still happens. He still gets killed by the soldier. So it toys with you a little bit during that part.
It does. And you do think that he's going to survive because the whole first part of the movie is the setup for how he deals with life. And mm-hmm. He does prevail. He does get the girl. He does get the bookstore. Mm-hmm. You know, all the obstacles in his way. He overcomes all of these things. And with a good heart and with a sense of humor and with a playfulness and with a way of couching things without telling the truth, like when his son says, hey, why does that sign say, you know, no Jews and dogs? Oh, well, everybody does what they want. You know, the other day. I saw a sign that said, you know, no Chinese people, no kangaroos. You know, we're going to put up our own sign. You know, what don't you like? And he says, spiders. And I don't want to see any more Visigoths. I've had it with the Visigoths. You know, so you can, watching it, you know exactly what it means, but you also see how he couches things. So mm-hmm. that when they get to the concentration camp and he makes up the story for his kid that it's a game and they're trying to win a tank, it's completely in keeping with how he's been through the whole rest of the movie. So it makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. And it is, but it's interesting, the movie is sort of like a tale of two films.
Yes.
The first half, which is pre-World War II, when the pre-concentration camp is a very, very, like a fairy tale.
Yes.
He woos this woman he's in love with. She's in a bad relationship, and sort of through his, you know, his charm and everything, they fall in love, and he gets the girl. And it's very happy. He even rolls out everything mm-hmm. he tries to impress her with works perfectly. And at the end, but in the second half, it's sort of the fairy tale-ness of it comes down to life, and he's got to deal with World War II, and because of his Jewish ancestry, he's put in a concentration camp. So it kind of has its two contrast halves of the movie.
But I think that's one of the reasons why it works. Because,
oh, yes.
You know, if it was the whole movie was about the Holocaust, it's a very tough subject. But this gives you who they were before. You know, you're mm-hmm. right. Boy meets girl. They fall in love, get married, they have a baby. But that's important because the second half, you're really aware of what they lost.
Exactly.
And that weighs on you.
Mm-hmm. And in a way, like, because of this, it feels a lot like a Chaplin movie. The way he kind of, you know, he bumbles around everywhere in the beginning of the movie. Like, I always like this scene at the beginning when the car is out of control. And he kind of stumbles along this town that's going to meet one of the military fascist leaders. And he's, like, giving this salute, like, get out of the way. But they're thinking he's giving them the fascist Heil Hitler sign.
Yeah, they think it's the king coming through.
Yeah.
And then the real king comes through and everybody's, like, backing up to go home.
Yeah, and there's just all of that, like, the scene with the eggs and he gets it on the one guy. And just a whole, like, a lot of slapstick stuff where it feels like a Charlie Chaplin movie. And like a Chaplin movie, there's always some pathos in the movie. You feel there's a lot of emotion in it, and you know, like if I had to pin down one Chaplin movie this feels similar to, would definitely be The Great Dictator.
Yes, there's elements of The Great Dictator, but also of The Kid. You know, mm-hmm. there's a, and he was a Benigni is a big fan of Chaplin. So some of the stuff that he does, you know, is taken right from Chaplin. There's a scene in one of the Chaplin movies where he's got a tray and he ends up putting a cat on it and carrying it out. And Benigni mm-hmm. does the same thing with a dog in this. You know, the playfulness between him and the son is very much like Chaplin and the child and the kid.
Yeah, definitely can see that. And, you know, and sort of another Chaplin comparison is just how much Benigni does in this movie. He's not only the director, he's also the star, and he also wrote the screenplay. So like Chaplin also did, he directed a lot of his movies, he worked on the screenplay, and even in those cases he would write the music. So another good comparison is this guy's involved in every aspect of this movie almost.
Roberto Benigni became only the fourth person to be nominated for Best Actor, Best Director, and Best Screenplay. The other recipients are Orson Welles and Woody Allen and Warren Beatty for Hamlet.
Annie Hall.
I'm sorry, for Citizen Kane, Annie Hall, and Reds.
Reds. Huh, I thought Eastwood would be in there, but I guess not.
Maybe not for I'm sure he's been nominated for all of those things, but not for the same movie.
Okay. And
so yeah, he was involved in every aspect of that film. I mean, that's really his film. Who else could do that movie?
Mm-hmm. I think
have to have that rubbery Steve Martin-y physicality.
You're right. And I don't think anybody could have pulled that character off with that, you know, the happiness for life and the cheer, even when everything else around him is terrible. Yeah, I don't think anybody. I couldn't see anybody else in this role. Even nobody. And another relation to Benigni is his wife, Nicoletta Braschi, and they've collaborated a lot of movies together, and she's been in a lot of movies he's directed, and I think that relationship they have really works well in this movie.
Yeah, the chemistry really comes across, and Life is Beautiful is the biggest moneymaker that's come out of Italy, but before that, the biggest movie was a movie called Il Mostro, The Monster, with Benigni and Nicoletta Braschi. Mm-hmm. And it's a slapstick farce about a guy who is, they're looking for a serial killer. And because Benigni's character does all these crazy things and they've been filming him, he looks like he's the guy. Of course, he's not the guy, right?
Yeah.
So he's squatting in an apartment that he won't pay the rent. And so they convince one of the police women, played by Nicoletta Braschi, to find a way to sublet the apartment mm-hmm. and come on to him and try to get him to attack her. That's the setup. So it's hilarious and farcical and was very, very popular and was only unseated when they made this movie together.
Hmm. And I know one other movie, I saw this a while ago, he did a few films with James Jarmusch. And they mm-hmm. did a film called
Coffee and Cigarettes?
No, that one too, but no, I was thinking of a film called Down by Law. It was an earlier one. And because Benigni kind of plays a convict, and it's sort of like he's with a couple other guys, and they break out of prison, and they hide out in this Italian woman's like restaurant or something for a couple of days, and that woman is Nicoletta Braschi.
Of course.
And so, other performance. One kind of interesting little tidbit of information was the doctor that they have. He kind of goes back mm-hmm. and forth with all those riddles.
Yes,
that was played by Horst Buchholz, and he. People probably best know him as the young, arrogant cowboy in the Magnificent Seven.
Okay.
So it's just kind of interesting that, the guy from Magnificent Seven is in an Italian movie.
You know, that's such a likable character. That's one of the, I think that was a nice touch that they included, you know, what happened to Dr. Lessing, because, you know, he seemed like such a nice person. You see how completely destroyed he is. You know, mm-hmm. even people on the other side, good people who got dragged into it, you know, going through the motions just sleepwalking and just dying inside.
Yeah, well, kind of one thing I noticed that how he's sort of clueless to what really is going on is, you know, the scene when Benigni and he's trying to talk to him and he thinks he can get him out or something because they're friends. And then the urgency the doctor is talking to is like, oh, I can't figure out this riddle. And then you don't know the pain I've been going through. And he's just like, I can't sleep at night because of this. And it's just like, you're saying that, you know, you can't find a riddle that's tormenting you, yet you're completely ignoring what's going on in this camp.
But see, I didn't read that way at all, because I think he was fixated on the riddle because he couldn't face what was going on around him. Because in the scene where Benigni recognizes him when he's examining all of the concentration camp inmates, mm-hmm. he's going through the motions like in slow motion, like he isn't even looking at people. And he looks right at Benigni's character and doesn't see him until he says something to him and then just sort of snaps out of it. You just see a guy who's, he's lost. I don't know. I felt a lot of sympathy for the character. He was so
I'm not saying he's necessarily taking part of all the atrocities that are going on, but it seems that he's sort of clueless to what's, you know, he's really ignoring it, you know, and, you know, he's, I don't know, because he's like saying, oh, it's been so painful for me trying to figure out this riddle that, you know, you really don't know what's going on and what, you know, what's being done to these people.
I thought the little boy who played the Joshua character was a tremendous little actor.
Yeah, and like he was like 3 or 4 years old when he did that movie.
Was he that young?
Yeah, he was born in, looked up, he was born in 1992, so he must have been really young.
Okay, because he was really very good, especially in the end when you see, you know, the tank show.
Yeah, that's such a great scene.
That's the greatest scene.
Mm-hmm. And he just has these great eyes like, it was true all along.
Yes.
And there was a looking at it, there's some, a couple of inspirations for the movie. One was, it was written by, he was like a comic, it was probably mispronounced this, Rubino Romeo Salmoni. And he wrote a book called In the End, I Beat Hitler. And it was just sort of, he served in a concentration camp and he was just sort of like telling these stories to his children, like what happened, but like he can't, you know, leaving out all the really dark graphic details, I think. And then it was also Roberto's father was in a concentration camp, and he talked about how he would create these crazy stories, sort of like in this movie, like to not tell his kids what, you know, what really happened to him when he was in this camp at that time.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you have to have some sort of, you have to have some version of the story to tell your children, but you're not going to give them all of the gory details because they're too young to really understand what that all means, and how could that happen to their father? Yeah, his dad spent 2 years in a Nazi labor camp. But Benigni explained his philosophy. To laugh and to cry comes from the same point of the soul. I'm a storyteller. The crux of the matter is to reach beauty, poetry. It doesn't matter if that is comedy or tragedy. They're the same if you reach the beauty.
Mm-hmm, that's a good point. I think what this film, reading about, there is controversy among this film because people think this is a, you know, Holocaust is not something to, you know, have comedic elements in. And, you know, that some people felt like they're, what's the word, making light of it or softening it down or making it not that big a deal. And I don't think that's the purpose at all of this movie. I think if that's how you've come out of it, I think you really didn't get the point. I mean, it does show the horrors of what was going on. Like, think of the scene when he's wandering around in the fog and he stumbles upon the pile of the dead bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, when the fact that it's known that all the other children have been executed except his son. Or the fact that the kid is hearing, you know, the stuff about the ovens and how they're using the bones to make buttons or soap or stuff. So they're not hiding away from it. And it's the fact is in this movie that the reason why there's the comedy elements, he's trying to get his kid to survive. If you tell a 4-year-old kid that we're going into a concentration camp, most likely you're going to be killed and I'm going to be killed too, that's going to break the kid.
Oh, and mom too.
And the mom too, yeah.
And we do see Uncle Elias or Elisio. I can't remember what his name is. You know what's happening. You know, he's going to the showers. And you see, you know, there's a woman who walks through who stumbles and he, you know, stops her from falling. And I've never been able to decide whether the look she gives him is contempt, don't touch me, or like Dr. Lessing. She knows what's happening, so she has to, you know, have a persona that is very stern to deal.
I think it's more of just contempt. Like, how dare you touch me? I think it's like that. I don't think she was feeling any pity or trying to hide any emotions. I think it was just more of she doesn't view him as a human being.
And he's such a great character. It's hard to see him go.
Mm-hmm. But so then I guess going back a little bit to about the controversy of this film, do you think that do you kind of see where the people who have who are don't like this movie because of the comedic elements or something? Do you see where they're getting at, or do you just think they missed the point entirely?
I respect that some people feel that this is too serious a subject to ever take lightly, but I also think there was a comic who said something like, "Show me someone who knows what's funny, and I'll show you someone who knows what isn't. So lots of times people who are comics like Benigni, I think, are very, very aware of tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have to have that sort of gravitas to get a joke across, because every joke has, you know, there's something that has to weigh down the joke. I don't know. I'm not putting that right, but I think it's impossible to be funny if you don't know what's not funny. If you don't know the sadder aspects of life.
Yeah, and then just going back to the Chaplin comparison we made earlier, like in the Great Dictator also faced that controversy. Like, I was just watching a documentary about Chaplin not too long ago, and one person said, I didn't really feel that the film about Hitler's rise to power and what he's doing to Europe should have been made into a slapstick comedy, what Chaplin did. And once again, with that movie, he's doing the usual, the Chaplin bit and mocking Hitler, just saying that this guy is a buffoon, but he's also showing what he's really doing to those people. And, you know, he's putting the people in the ghetto who are the Jews and everything. And it's that stuff isn't meant to be, he's not putting that in a funny light. And he gives this emotional speech about what needs to happen. So like in Great Dictator and like in this movie, you're reaching a lot of people by having slapstick and having comedy and elements, but you can also have the message where people still get what you're going at, I think.
You know, there's a funny line in the movie Chaplin, the Attenborough movie, where Kevin Kline plays, he plays Douglas Fairbanks, and this is right before Chaplin made The Great Dictator, and they're leaving a party, and he says, hey, if you notice Hitler's mustache, he stole your act.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of movies that it reminds you of, there is a scene in there I always point out to my students, because Shawshank Redemption came out the year before, and there's a what I call the old playing the music across the courtyard to, get a message to somebody who's imprisoned trick. And Shawshank does it very well, of course, and it uses an Italian opera, The Marriage of Figaro, and that's my favorite scene in Shawshank.
Oh, yeah.
And he does it twice, actually, in Life is Beautiful. There's one point where he's got the kid with him in the wheelbarrow, and, the radio guy goes out for a minute, so they get on the radio real quick, and they say, buongiorno, Principessa, of course. And then the kid says, mamma. And she now realizes, because she can hear, that even though she's just been told all the kids have been killed, somehow her husband is alive, so is the son, and, and now they're hiding. And it gives her hope. And then later, when he's at the, when he's serving the German officers, and he comes across the Victrola, and he sees an album, and it's the song that he and his wife heard at the when they went to the opera, early on when they met. So he plays that across the courtyard, and of course she hears it and knows that he's still out there. But to me, it's straight off ripoff from Shawshank.
Yeah, like, I watched that scene last night. I was like, oh, wow, that's a lot like Shawshank Redemption, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then one thing I also really liked about the movie, and okay, I got to mention this, because one of my favorite all-time movie is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Okay.
And the cinematographer on this movie was Tonino Delicali, and he worked with Leone on The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and he also did Once Upon a Time in the West and Once Upon a Time in America. And I feel the cinematography in this film, it was also really stands out, especially just all the shots of them just at that little village city, and it just looks gorgeous. The way he uses the sunlight, and it's really good. I always really like that guy's work.
Well, it's Tuscany, so it's hard to make it look bad. But yeah, even the way it starts off, it's in the countryside, and they're driving with no brakes, and people think that they're the king, and he comes across this little farm and meets Nicoletta Bracci's character. Yeah, it's all very bucolic, very safe. It certainly doesn't feel like the Holocaust is going to happen, which is the point.
Exactly.
It is that, no one sees it coming. They're just living their lives.
There's just that, even that at first act, there's only the little passing reference when when his uncle's horse gets graffitied with, this is a Jewish horse. And that's it. But it's sort of hinting, what's going to happen later, but just hinting that little part at the beginning.
And then there'd be that little music of doom that would be in the background, too.
Exactly.
To make sure you didn't miss the part that, this has some import somehow.
Yeah, and then talking about the cinematography out there, the restaurant was also has a lot of great use of colors. Like, I remember the first time he goes in there when he's practicing and he's trying to get the job. It's like all in this white, everything's like getting, you know, looks like it's getting renovated or whatever. And then like then when there's the big parties, it's got all these greens and reds, and it looks just, once again, this guy's cinematography is excellent.
Yeah, and the party gives a chance to throw some eggs on the bad the bad man, but a really, really big egg.
And that's the scene when he doesn't notice and the dog's on his little waiter thing. And another thing I think that's really touching about the movie, and one of the it also helped that kind of made me tear up at the end, was the music by Nicola Piovani, and I believe he won an Oscar for this. I could be wrong.
I think he did too. I think there were several Oscars for this, and I think that was one of them, was the music.
Yeah, and I think the da-da-da-da, that part, and once again, that's played at the end when it's the emotional reunion, when he's reunited with his mother. And, like, yeah, once you're playing that with the motion of that scene, with that music, just like, man, that just gets me every time. And it's, you know, we're talking about the Oscars. This is Benigni at the Oscars. This is one of the more famous, like, moments in Oscar history, because he won it twice. He won Best Foreign Film. And then he won Best Actor. And he jumped up around. He jumped everywhere. He was so happy. And he was like, "Are you sure you got the right person?" He was like, "My English is all used up. You got the wrong person." It was one of the great moments.
One of the great moments. And in fact, the following year when Billy Crystal was hosting, he brought a butterfly net just in case Benigni won something else. So they could chase him down. But, you know, he is always like that. Mm-hmm. Very much like Robin Williams, where they're on all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you see him in any sort of interview, he's always like that. I have a clip that I show the class where he's on the Graham Nash show, and he talks about meeting the Pope, because the Pope heard about the movie and he wanted to see it, so he contacted Benigni, and this was Pope John Paul, you know, the most beloved Pope of all time. And he talks to Graham Nash, and he says, you know, for the visiting president of the United States, Clinton, he only gave an hour, but for me, a whole day. They showed it in the Vatican with a group of nuns. And he said he was so excited to meet the Pope that he jumped on him for the joy.
Yeah, and once again, that's just, yeah, like you said, a Robin Williams or a Chaplin. Mm-hmm. The guy's always, you know, out there having fun. You can always
bouncing
see he's just
walls.
Trying to, you know, make people laugh and, you know, entertain them. And so talking about the rest of the directing career, Benigni, I looked at him. After this film, it's sort of like he fell off. I guess he had two flops that didn't make a lot of money. They were very poorly received, too. Last one came in 2005. It was like The Tiger in the Snow or something.
With Nicoletta Bracci.
Which is wife again. And before that, he did a Pinocchio movie, which I heard got terrible reviews. And it's like, he's directed quite a few movies. A number of them have been successes. It's just interesting that it's been over a decade since his last movie, because he's had two stinkers.
He's done some cameo stuff, like the Jim Jarmusch that you mentioned. And I believe he was in Woody Allen's To Rome with Love.
Okay. So he's still acting. But
still out there. I think he's probably, you know, after you do something, I think if it was me, if I did a movie like Life is Beautiful, I wouldn't want to make something that was better.
Yeah, almost just like, just go out there. Like, it's just not going to get any better after that.
Yeah, I mean, I would be content to still make good movies, but I would never want to surpass this one, because it was, you know, for the amount of awards that it received and the just the perfection that went into it, just in terms of the writing. You know, the writing in it is so incredibly strong. So many great parallels. Like, you see in the beginning that the kid doesn't want to take a shower.
That's what saves him.
And he hides in a like a end table, and he ends up hiding in something very much like that later. And and all the riddles, you know, about Snow White and the 7 seconds and the falling key and the fact that they keep coming back to Schopenhauer, because that's funny, because he was a favorite philosopher of Hitler's.
Oh, really?
So the fact that they use that Schopenhauer thing. To win, yeah. Yes, is another kind of little smart little dig. It's so witty and intellectual on some levels, and so much of a heart-rending story that you don't need to know anything else about to enjoy. It's just, it has everything.
The best parts of that Schopenhauer thing he's trying to do when he's at the opera, and he sees her in the balcony, and he's trying, like, look at me. But then the woman next to him, like, smiles at him because she thinks he's talking to her.
I can only hear out of this side of my, yes, yeah. I can only hear out of this ear.
And so if I had to, like, let's say I was teaching a course on Italian cinema, I probably would say this is the best example. I think it's the most celebrated film in Italian history. You said it's one of the, it's the highest grossing, you said?
Mm-hmm.
I just think, and it just, like I said, everything's hitting on the right notes. It's got amazing music. It's got a great directing and performance by Benigni. Beautiful cinematography, an emotional story that I think everyone can like. It's not like, you know, so, and it just, everyone can like it. It may not be a, not like really artsy like something Fellini did or something, or everyone can connect to it. So I would, if I had to show somebody one Italian movie, would be this one.
Well, that's one of the reasons I picked it. It's contemporary, but it's also historical. Mm-hmm. It's it stars a director who did very well, who's still making movies. So the introduction to him, at least, if nothing else, because not everybody has the same sense of humor. If you like this movie, you know you're going to like his other stuff. And if you don't like him in this movie, then you know also you're probably going to not like his other stuff.
Yeah, not for you. And so how do you bring this in one of your classes? How do you bring this film in there?
I use this in World Cinema as the Italian movie. For years, I used Cinema Paradiso, which is also a great example. But this one, because I only want to do one World War II movie. You know, you could actually do a World War II movie from every country. You know, there's so many good ones. But you get a little bit of fatigue going, so you have to pick one. And I use this one, and then I contrast it with The Boy in the Striped Pajamas.
Okay.
Because they're both stories from the kid's point of view. Mm-hmm. One kid doesn't realize he's in a concentration camp, and his father's, you know, they're Jewish. The other kid doesn't realize, you know, what's involved in his dad being an SS officer. So it's two ends of the spectrum. But it's the same experience. The minute they meet another kid, all they want to do is play.
Yeah.
That's what kids want to do. Mm-hmm. You're just so excited that they're your age. That's the only criteria.
Mm-hmm.
The kids in Life is Beautiful that he ends up playing hide and seek with, they never even introduce each other. And no one says, where'd you come from? Because kids don't care. So it's a good way to make the situation the same, but then look at how differently they treat the subject, especially from two different angles.
Yeah, and just, you know, thinking of like how different this film is treating the Holocaust the way, you know, like Schindler's List would. It's very different. Both very good, very effective, but different, like, styles.
Very different styles.
Yeah. And then just, you know, looking at Italian cinema, just like you talked about with Life is Beautiful, there's always this, you know, like, Life is Beautiful, another great movie, one of the few I've also teared up at the end. And, you know, that's also a great intro, like, just for loving of cinema. It's about a guy who worked at a theater for years and goes on to become a director and hit this, you know, the things going on in his life. And that's a great movie. And my all-time favorite movie, I've said earlier, is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, spaghetti western. I've seen a ton of those. So, man, Italians just make great movies.
They do make great movies.
Okay, then. So you talked about it. Anything else I haven't covered that you want to bring up?
I did want to mention that the name of the movie comes from a quote by Leon Trotsky. While he was in exile in Mexico, he knew he was about to be killed by Stalin. He saw his wife in the garden and wrote that, in spite of everything, life is beautiful. That's interesting when you think about it. You wouldn't think that would be the day you would make that comment. But that's really what it is about, like, even in the worst of things.
Yeah, and one thing that connects perfectly to this movie, like, he's trying, you know, he still has this love of life and everything. He never loses his spirit. Even at the very end when he's being marched to his death, he's still doing the little dance and winking at his kid and, keeping the kid's hopes up, saying that it's going to be all right, even though when he knows, like, I'm going to die in a few minutes.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, then. So last question I have is, you talked about it a little bit earlier, so tell us about all the classes you got going on.
This semester I am teaching World Cinema, Women in Film, and the history of animated film. Those are in the classroom, and then online I'm teaching American cinema and intro to the humanities. Next fall I'll do world cinema, American, and intro to film, and also Hitchcock online.
Sounds great. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about Roberto Benigni and his 1997 classic, Life is Beautiful. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying buongiorno, Principessa.